Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Janet Yellen confirmed as the Secretary of the Treasury. I got to tell you, a little surprised by the vote, 84 to 15. Maybe there's a honeymoon period. Maybe Biden's going to get some love here. But 84 to 15, we haven't seen votes like that in a long time. So happy to see that. Here to share some thoughts on, Yellen as the Treasury Secretary. I've asked our good friend Pedro DaCosta to come talk with us. Pedro is the senior reporter at Market News, also does some fabulous work over at Forbes and Market Watch. Pedro, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
So what are your thoughts on Janet Yellen?
First of all, shame on us for never having a woman Treasury Secretary before. Second of all, I think the vote count, I think, speaks to her kind of political savvy that she's had to build up over time as, you know, first as Federal Reserve Governor. She was vice chair before she was chair. And then as chair herself, she had to go up on the Hill a lot. She had to deal with these lawmakers personally. And so I think they knew who they were voting for kind of for the third time around. You know, this is not her first rodeo as far as a confirmation. And then thirdly, I would say she's just a very competent individual, you know, whatever you might think about her politics. There was some fear that progressives didn't think she was progressive enough. And I'd argue that I watched her career starting, when I started watching it, she was at the San Francisco Fed. And I think that her chairmanship at the Fed definitely shifted the central bank toward a focus on social issues like inequality and race that previously didn't exist. And she deserves a lot of credit for that. So all in all, it's hard to criticize her as a choice. She's certainly overqualified, as women usually are who come into position.
Yeah. I'm looking at the future that she's got ahead of her. The first thing that's going to have to get passed is this $1.9 trillion rescue package that they're putting out. You've got a bunch of Republicans now who are kind of balking at this. And there's a possibility it doesn't go through. What are your thoughts on her work getting that through?
Yeah, it's not easy. I think it's her work getting it through also requires some convincing of Democrats as well, because there's not universal agreement on the amount of size of the checks that's supposed to be sent out to individuals, even though that's not really the core of the stimulus. So I think there's still going to be the signals that we got from the administration today is that they're willing to make concessions. And I think $1.9 trillion was an opening salvo. But the context that I was thinking about coming into your show is that, you know, I think last time we were on, I can't quite remember, but, you know, maybe a month or two ago, we basically, in December before the election, we had the prospect of not even having a second stimulus after the March $2 trillion, right? Now, not only have we had the $900 trillion in December, we're about to have another trillion in change, and I think there's the prospect of more down the line. So economic prospects, I think the prospects of the economy generally have changed because of the proactive shift toward, you know, a greater fiscal stimulus. And that happened in part because of the Georgia victory and what that meant for Democrats.
Yeah. I said, you know, when Biden came out with this idea, that this to me is a signal, because I remember the Obama years. I remember, you know, right when Obama came to office and the talk for a stimulus package that they severely scaled back. It was nowhere near big enough, in my view. It should have been much more bold, much more chunky, if you will, to give us a bigger jolt. To have Biden come out and say, no, this is what we're going after, to me was a positive sign that maybe he'd learned the lesson of where Obama had, I think, had fallen down.
Well, he was certainly at the White House. So, although if you talk in terms of amounts, you could argue that $1.9 trillion in terms of proportionate to the size of the economy now and proportionate to the need of the pandemic isn't that much larger of an opening salvo. And some people would even, you know, were initially talking about a lot more. I think the issue is a question of momentum and political viability, though. Again, if we went from not having any fiscal aid at all and having, including the Republican Fed chair, Trump appointee, go up to the Hill and say, please do more because I kind of don't have the tools anymore. I can't cut rates any further. So if you don't do anything, you know, it doesn't really, our low interest rates don't really help. to having, you know, momentum toward more being done, and also the prospect of additional help coming potentially later, you know, this summer.
Yeah, now I'm looking at the $1,400 that where the Republicans seem to be balking at, saying that, you know, certain people need it or certain people don't. And I'm in this moment where, yeah, maybe some people don't necessarily need it to survive, but it's probably, in my view, not a bad idea to get that kind of money into the economy, because we do need in the next several months to kind of ramp up consumption. So by having some of that disposable money maybe laying around, probably not a bad idea, no?
Well, here's what's fascinating to me, Rick, watching this from Washington, where I've now been for, I think, 10 years, it turns out. I think I'm getting to my 10th anniversary. Is that we're strangely having a kumbaya moment across political lines in the economics profession about deficits and about, you know, you had this gathering recently at my former employer, the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and it was the cross spectrum of Democrats, but all the way from hawkish Bob Rubin to progressive deficit dove Joe Stiglitz, and with Larry Summers in between. And the trio kind of agrees that deficits are a good idea now because of the kind of low interest rate burden of the United States, and that it wouldn't make sense to not make certain investments. And so from a macro perspective, there's agreement, but there's still kind of political jockeying over the deficit. And I think you know how that works as far as depending who's in power, who cares the most about the deficit.
But, yeah, because we're going to hear a lot more of that austerity talk. Oh, we got to worry about our grandchildren now. When you're right, now like when Obama took the reins, while we were losing a million jobs a month, while the economy was in terminal velocity, free fall, it was the same scenario. You know, countries were giving us money to hold on to as a deflationary bet. We can borrow it at near zero. So now's the time to invest in all that infrastructure that's been not dealt with for the last 12, 15 years. Now's time to really invest heavily in the country while money is so cheap.
And of course, the pandemic revealed some of the gaps in that infrastructure, not just, you know, as far as what we think of as infrastructure with highways and roads, but our healthcare infrastructure and all the other little infrastructures that turns out didn't work quite as well or smoothly as we previously thought. So there's definitely a case to be made that there's been underinvestment in the U.S. economy. There's also a case to be made that the payments they're not targeted as far as like whether you lost your job or not, but there's also a case to be made that people who aren't reached by the unemployment insurance system and so on, who might actually need the money, who wouldn't be caught by this net otherwise. And so, to your point, as long as there's an income cap, there's still a stimulative kind of effect, because you're giving money to people most likely to spend it.
No, and that's, you know, that's the whole discussion. And we're giving people you know, the resource to make it through this pandemic, to stay home if they need to. And we should have been doing that from the beginning. I was saying that we should have extended unemployment to people on a voluntary basis, so they, if they didn't want to risk getting ill, that they could stay home and we help them get through that. And now Joe Biden has said that they're going to help pursue that policy so that people can, if they are, you know, high risk or they simply don't want to be exposed, have the ability to make the choice to stay home.
One of the things that's been kind of depressing to watch is how we went from idolizing this quote-unquote essential worker, right? Because a friend of mine, Ronald Sharp, the economist, likes to say that it's essential work, but disposable workers, actually, because, you know, really, they weren't treated as essential. But we've gone from that initial phase, and we were all in such panic that we idolized the delivery person, to kind of forgetting about them a little bit. And so that's kind of a sad aspect of this crisis, is that initial feeling of, like, heroism and, you know, nobility that we all felt about some very basic work that used to be undervalued. I feel like we've gone back to undervaluing. I think of it often when I see cab drivers, you know, Uber drivers who have to be in tight spaces all day long with random people and just exposing themselves to COVID in every way possible. It's, you know, a lot of people putting themselves in harm's way.
Yeah, also we can get a cheeseburger. I mean, I'm just stuck by that, you know, because I look at all of the, like, the restaurant workers who have really gotten the short end of the stick in this whole thing because we didn't really help them long enough. I mean, the extra $600 that was going out in unemployment benefits was really pointed at them to help them get by. And you got people like Lindsey Graham saying, oh, that's too much. They don't need that much. I mean, it's really remarkable to me that people who have probably never missed a meal are complaining that someone's getting something of a meal. It's crazy.
I had an interesting conversation with Bill Spriggs, who's chief economist at the NFL, and he's advised the Biden campaign as far as labor and things. And he made the very interesting point that the lack of support for small businesses isn't just a one-time issue, because kind of Wall Street and potential investors seized that reaction. And now it means that raising money for future ventures will always be, you know, will be even more difficult, because the prospect of potential catastrophic events that could generate losses is now seen as higher, in the sense that there will be no support if such a catastrophe arises is rightfully embedded in people's psyche. So yeah, there's kind of a long-term damage to the sector that, of course, has that K-shaped effect of favoring large chains and so on that can bear the brunt of periodic losses.
So now, in this plan that Biden, this rescue plan that Biden has come forth with, is there sufficient amounts of money to help those small businesses? Because I know we like to talk about small business, but without actually saying what a small business is. You know, there were the years that they were talking about, you know, Halliburton being a small business. No, they're not. When I think of a small business, I'm thinking about the restaurant down the street where we know the people who own the place, and they're the ones who open the doors in the morning and close them at night. That, to me, is a small business. But are we doing enough in this package, as you see it, to help those folks?
It doesn't seem like we're there yet, although the commitment has been really strong. I mean, Neera Tanden, who's going to be OMB head, who's nominated to be OMB head, she came out in her first kind of press briefing and just emphasized how big a deal they're going to make it. So I don't quite know yet. The money doesn't seem to be allocated that's sufficient, again, for the obliteration of the small business sector that we've had to date. And also, there's been, as you know, there were these Fed facilities set up with the Treasury that were kind of ended by the Trump administration. So there's talk that potentially Janet Yellen could revive some of them. So I'm thinking about the Main Street Lending Facility in particular, which was aimed at small businesses and which actually started to work towards the end, and was, they had to reduce the sort of loan size to reach smaller and smaller businesses. But again, there's a lot of people who've been left in the lurch, and it's going to be a long game of catch up.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There's a long game of catch up here. Now, small businesses being one thing, but you start looking at, you know, city and county governments and state governments, municipalities. You look at the tax losses that they're going to incur, and you had Mitch McConnell, who was hell bent on not giving them anything. Biden's talked about, you know, doing something there.
That is in the package in a significant way, and I think that there's definitely a focus by administration to make sure that happens. So that's important. That was, again, a key lesson from the last downturn, is that because of balanced budget requirements in states and localities, you get this kind of reinforcement effect where you get layoffs at the worst possible time instead of government serving as an automatic stabilizer. It actually accelerates the employment losses, and there's no need for that to happen.
Yeah, you know, I just had this weird conversation today with a guy who he was trying to explain to me that, back, 40 years ago, he was making, more money than he's making today. Now, he was making like four times the minimum wage at the time, and life was so much better. And I'm trying to absorb this guy's position, because, my own experience is somewhat, along those lines. And I'm trying to get to this place where, inflation has continued to go up. Wages haven't. And it comes back down to bargaining power, in my view. And this guy just wanted to focus on, we can't possibly raise the minimum wage because it's gonna make my life worse. How do you get past that kind of thinking? Because, he hit every right-wing talking point. Cheeseburger's gonna be $27.50, and we're never gonna be able to afford one. And nobody else is gonna get a raise, and everybody's gonna be mad. How do you get past that?
It's hard, and there's been a lot of, it took a long time for the economics profession, to be honest, to even, for there to be progressive economists who actually supported a minimum wage increase, because the bias was so built into the models that, like, they always found losses. And so that actually has changed significantly, to my earlier point about there being a shift in economics that's not reflected in politics so much, to the point where most economists don't actually think that that's the case. That might be the case in certain local economies where the minimum wage is, the local wage is really low. But again, that's just a sign of just how weak these local economies are. And so having some kind of intervention that stabilizes that, might be harmful to certain businesses, but you have to question the viability of a business that can't pay its workers.
I'm right there with you. So you said a couple of times that the thinking of the economic community has changed a little bit. And kind of my last question for you is, all of these things that we've been fed Reagan forward, like tax cuts for the rich are how we're going to create jobs, or if we slash taxes on big business, it's going to create jobs. That hasn't worked out. Is that still the consensus of the dismal science folks?
No, and that's the amazing thing is, like, I mean, no, there's very little support for trickle down economics, even in Republican economic circles, I would say. Even for people that argue for small government, there's not a great sense that tax cuts for the rich have been productive in the long run. So I think that consensus has shifted, but again, politics is a little bit slower. So
I hope you're right. I hope we get away from the trickle down theory and we wake up to the reality that no, tax cuts for rich people, not great. In fact, we should go back to the way it was during the good socialist presidency of Dwight David Eisenhower, and we tax them and use that money to build our infrastructure, pay for schools, do all of that stuff. But we got a long road ahead of us to get there. But Pedro, I appreciate the time. Always good talking with you, my friend.
My pleasure, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. Our good friend Pedro DaCosta, senior reporter over at Market News. Make sure you check out his work there, marketnews.com. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.